Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 14th of Tishrei for Erev Sukkot. I want to point out that when I pick these tshuvot to study together, I don't pick them in a row. So I'll pick one and then go through a cycle, because, for example, if I'm doing these shiurim 5 days a week, I'll pick five in a row, but on separate days. I'll do them one a day, so I won't always remember what I did the previous day. And then also, I've done them for a while now. I did them in writing. I do them at TorahMusings.com, and I send them out by email. If you want to get on that email list, you can email me at grothst@gmail.com. But, so I don't pick them right in a row. So it turns out, the last time we were together, last Thursday, on the 11th of Tishrei, we had a discussion of letting a husband remarry without needing a heter meir rabbanim. That's a topic that comes up. You know, issues of divorce and gittin and things like that are very, very common in the tshuvot that I've been finding, which either is just I happen to be finding them, or that means that that was really a great topic of, by great, I don't mean as in good or better than good, I mean as in a very prevalent topic of conversation for these meshivim. So it happens to be that today as well, we're going to have a discussion of whether a husband can get married again without a get or without a heter meir rabbanim, without needing to go to 100 rabbis for permission. And this time, part of what moved me to take it, I don't think I remember at the time that the 11th of Tishrei was also on this topic, but also it's in Yabia Omer. It is in the Tshuvot, in the response of Rav Avadya Yosef, who was, you know, made his reputation, as it were, based on his remarkable Tshuvot, his remarkable response. And I always look for opportunities to use Yabia Omer, but I will say that he doesn't come up that often in my searches by date, I think because he very frequently didn't date his Tshuvot, which he's not required to do, but it means that if my selection process goes through by finding dates, I don't have as many opportunities to learn from Rav Avadya Yosef as maybe we would like to. So therefore, I take up that chance. So even if it sounds like it's going to be somewhat of a repeat, it's, I think, worth it because Rav Avadya Yosef is certainly, I think, more influential, even, not a judgment call, not a matter of judging who's better or worse, but more influential than Rav Yosef Shaul Natanzon was with his Shoel LeMeishiv. So in Yabia Omer, the seventh volume in the Eben Ezer part, Siman Dalet, from the 14th of Tishrei of Tufshin Memvav. Tufshin Memvav would be 1985. 14th of Tishrei of 1985, he got a question from Mordechai Piron, who was the chief rabbi of Zurich, who I looked up a little bit online because I know the name Shai Piron isn't currently a religious Israeli politician. I wanted to know if there was a connection. I couldn't find any connection. But this is Mordechai Piron from Zurich, who passed away relatively recently at the age of 93. So I think in the early 2000s. I'm sorry, 2014. He was born in 1921. This is Mordechai Piron had been the chief rabbi of Tzahal, the second chief rabbi of Tzahal. And then he moved to Zurich after his time in Tzahal and the IDF was over. And he was also involved in a controversial other marriage case. There was a case in the early 70s where Rav Gorin allowed two people who had been determined to be mamzerim to marry. It was a whole political issue and a religious issue and a big concern. So this Mordechai Piron had then married the boy of that brother and sister pair who had been declared mamzerim. He married him after Rav Gorin paskin with the Beis Din that they weren't mamzerim. Story of its own. But this from Mordechai Piron, it's a case in Zurich. So it's just interesting because it seems like he, among the things that he leaves as a legacy in his halakhic world, is that he's involved in cases of problematic marriages. He's a rav in Zurich, and here's what happens. There was a man who had married, unfortunately, had fallen in love with a non-Jewish woman, and he got married to her, and he had her convert. But the conversion wasn't before like an authoritative Beit Din. He got together three guys who claimed to know what they were doing, and they converted the woman. They got married with a chuppah and kiddush, like a Jewish wedding. And then after a while, they separated. They got a civil divorce. She, the woman, went and married a non-Jew, and there are now some witnesses who claim that she's pregnant by the non-Jew. She claims she never really meant to convert, and it was only because the man who she at the time felt had close feelings for wanted her to convert, so he should be happy with her, she converted. But now she sees her completely as back to whatever she was, you know, a Christian probably, if it's in Zurich, Switzerland, but she sees herself as non-Jewish, and she has no interest in coming to a Jewish court to accept a get, a writ of divorce, and she wants to forget the whole thing. So here you have, so this is not the tshuva, but for me, it's one of the issues that comes up a lot, and I think about a lot, is that we today, I think many people I know today, are very much in favor of, oh, if a couple wants to get married and all she has to do is convert, you should convert her or him or whoever it is. You should just be easy with conversions to allow people to get married. And I think one of the downsides is you have these people who then all problems can come up, especially if, so this is one kind of a case, but another case where it comes up is, let's say, if people want to adopt babies and they're not themselves all that from, or they are, you know, somewhat religious, but there's no guarantee, sadly, in our times, that when you raise a child, the child's going to stay observant. So you have a baby who's not Jewish and is not obligated to any mitzvot, and then you convert them, and then they end up, let's say, not being observant. So all of a sudden, all the times they violate Shabbos are violations of Shabbos by a Jew. So I think these are problematic, difficult questions. Here's one example of it, because now she's refusing to get divorced. Now this man has met another convert. So it's interesting. Somebody years ago said to me that it was odd how many Kohanim he knew. A rabbi said, it was odd how many Kohanim he knew who fell in love with divorcees. And halakhically, Kohanim were not allowed to marry divorcees. And it's like there's some kind of an attraction there, and because it's forbidden fruit, who knows what. But this man seems to have had a thing for an originally non-Jewish woman. But he met them, but the difference is this Gio, or this convert, had converted before she met him. And she converted not in front of a problematic Beit Din. It was a perfectly valid conversion. She is a model of what a convert should be, a model of what a Jewish woman should be, right? The whole community of Zurich loves her, and she's great. She keeps mitzvot, and she's very careful about it. And she's now had an influence on this man to return to observance and to become observant. And they want to get married, but she's only willing to marry him and if he stays observant and is observant. So he needs a divorce, right? So you obviously want to help this couple get together from our halakhic perspective, because they seem like a good, fine Jewish couple. Why would we want them to get together? So he needs to get divorced, but he can't get a divorce because the woman's not willing to accept a divorce. And even in 1985, getting 100 rabbanim in three different countries to sign a chetamei rabbanim was going to be a difficult situation. So the question that Rav Mordechai Piron asked Rav Avadya Yosef was, is there a way to let the man get married in, even without a heter mea rabbanim? Now, I pointed out last time that people get sort of bristle at the heter mea rabbanim idea because they think it's an unfair advantage for the man over the woman, and I fully understand what their concerns are and how it bothers them and why they're upset about it. So in this tshuva, as it happens, the goal is to not have to get a heter mea rabbanim, right? It's going to go even a step further, freeing the man to remarry even without a heter mea rabbanim. But in doing so, I think that Rav Avadya Yosef shows us some underlying ideas that, in my experience, haven't always governed psak, governed the rulings when it comes to women who are stuck with men who won't give them pills of getting. So those are more complicated situations, because a woman really certainly cannot get remarried without a get. But the concern for helping people who are right now stranded and unable to marry, I think that's one that applies equally in halakha to men and to women. The question is what tools we have available to help them in those situations. So on the woman's situation, we're not going to talk about today at all, but it's something to keep in mind, that I think it's important to keep in mind that we sometimes, I think in my experience, meet rabbanim who are careful about technicalities of halacha and worries about technicalities of halacha that leave people stranded. And I think Rav Avadya Yosef here is going to show an example of that. We don't want to leave people stranded, that it's important for us to find ways not to leave people stranded. So here's how he starts. There is a tshuva of the Maharashi Dhamma. So the Maharashi Dhamma quotes a Rashba. The Maharashi Dhamma is living in the 1500s, and the Rashba lives in the 1200s. So the Rashba in the 1200s says that when Rabbeinu Gersha made his ruling to not marry two wives, that was only because the worry was that you'd have people who would be prutzim, who would just marry lots and lots of women, and you'd have a problem. He, I think, Rabbeinu Gersha, we said last time, also was worried that maybe he wouldn't be able to support her. But we just didn't want two marriages going on at the same time. But the Maharashi Dhamma says, in the name of the Rashba, that whenever, no, I think the Maharashi Dhamma is saying for himself now, but whenever the husband could have forced her to accept a divorce. So in halacha, it's clearly true, this is not controversial, it's an aside of mine, a digression, but it's clearly true, there are times when halacha says this man has the right to divorce this woman against her will, even though Rabbeinu Gershom came along later, so we don't do that, but that the man has the absolute right. And there are times when the woman has the absolute right to have a man give her a get, and the court should be forcing the man to give her a get. So in those situations is where Rashdam is saying. So in, when the man could min adin force her to accept a get or marry a woman, another woman, because of her conduct that makes her not an acceptable, appropriate wife for him right now, and he has the right to get rid of her. Rashdam says he thinks that Rabbeinu Gershom didn't make his gzeira there at all. In other words, the idea that we can't marry two wives, it was not an absolute rule. It was a rule that applied where a man has a current valid wife with whom he is in a marriage, with whom he's allowed to stay married, who has not done anything wrong that should mean that he should get rid of her. But if she has made it such that they can't really be married anymore, either that he has the right to divorce her against her will because of things that she's done, or that he has the right to marry another woman because she's not really serving as his wife in some important ways, whatever those are. So there's not even a gzera at all. So the Rashdam says, and whether or not that's true, I mean, he thinks that's true, but maybe it's not true, but it's at least a suffix, he says. It's at least possibly true. It's a claim in halacha. So what he's going to say is that when you have a claim in halacha, that creates a suffix. Maybe he's allowed to get married without a heter merib on him and to ignore cheir ben gershom. And there's another suffix, another doubt, which is that, as we saw last time, there were those who claimed Rabbeinu Gershom's gzeira only lasted until the end of the Elef HaChamishi, until the end of the 5,000, until around the year 1240, and then maybe went away. So you've got these two sfeikot, and in two sfeikot, that's called a sfeik sfeika. So there are times in halacha when we allow ourselves to be more lenient about a sfeik sfeika, about a double suffeik. Then the Marashtam adds words that I think should ring true throughout the centuries: Shebevadai lo yale al hadat. Certainly, it's clearly got to be true. Nobody would think that he'd be chained to a woman who's not willing to be married to him, is not serving as a wife, because there are a lot of isurim involved. There are a lot of prohibitions involved in people being forced to be not just single, but forced to be in a marriage and yet not able to act on a marriage. So that's true, I'm pretty sure, both for the man and the woman, and I'm not always sure that we are aware of those things. In any case, the Marazam goes on, the Torah drakeha darchei noam. And we have a pasuk that says that the ways of Torah are ways of pleasantness, which again, I would say, Gideon Rosti would say, reminds us that if the Torah is looking like a thing that's not drakeha darchei noam, we have to be very careful to be sure that that's the way the Torah needs to be applied in our times, because in general it's supposed to be true that drachei hadarchei noam. And therefore the Marashtam said, there's no doubt that he can get remarried, and if somebody stops him, that's a sin. That's the Marashtam. So the Marashtam's case isn't exactly the case here, but it's a building up the idea that if the woman is not a viable marital partner right now, that leaves room for us to say that he can get remarried even without a heter merib on him. Another support for this position, for this idea, there's a shoot between Chaim Cohen Rappaport, who I looked up a little bit, couldn't really find, but is a Rav Yosef has this extensive library that he knows well and uses well. Chaim Cohen Rappaport had said that if the woman had committed adultery, so in halacha, as we said last time, and it's interesting to watch that Rav Yosef Shaul Datanzon and Rav Ovadia Yosef have very different libraries, very different sources that they use and that they rely upon. So, but they come to many of the same conclusions, although not all the same. So here, if the woman has had an adulterous affair, so as we said last time, they're not allowed to stay married to each other. So then, if she's not willing to accept the get, Rav Chaim said, then you don't need a heter merabanim either, because the whole issue of needing a heter merabanim that had been mentioned, that was where she's done nothing wrong. She's just, let's say, unable to have children, or she's ill. So let's say there's a man who's married to a woman who's ill, or married to a woman who can't have children. He wants to have children. She doesn't want to accept to get. And we have a cherem b'nei gershom, or a cherem b'nei gershom that we don't divorce her against her will, or he just doesn't want to, he doesn't want the marriage to her, but he wants another wife in that way. So it's unclear to me whether you would do that. But in those situations, you didn't have to bear about it, right? Examples would be, like we saw last time, if a woman is institutionalized because she's unfortunately mentally ill. So those are situations, but said Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, Bezinta, if she had an affair, Vinesra Alav, and he can't stay married to her. Halachically, he's not allowed to stay married to her. So then it's obvious to him that there was no Chayr Ben Gershom at all. So in all these sources that we're seeing now, the question becomes, this tradition of Chayr Ben Gershom, that you can't marry two wives, how broad was it? How absolute was it? So this Reb Chaim Kori Rapport is suggesting that if she did something that halachically forces the marriage to end, so then you don't need to have to marry a bunny. There was never any Chayim Begira Gershom. And he says the Ma'arik has that, and Rabbi Yisrael Chanan had that, about a woman who had an affair. So now the next level would be, let's say we're not sure she had an affair, but there's a tshuva in Yeshua Malcha that he quotes, or Rabbi Yosef quotes, about, let's say she's just, we know that she secludes herself, right? She has yichud. So yichud is a situation where there could have been inappropriate, you know, adulterous activity going on, but we don't have any evidence of it, except the people that she lets herself be alone with are people known to be promiscuous and lewd and act in ways that aren't appropriate and aren't acceptable. And there is one witness that she committed, had an affair. That's not enough halakhically as evidence, right? So it's not like he could force her, it's not like he'd come to a court and say, it's clear that we have to get divorced because of this, because you only have one witness, and one witness in halakha doesn't fully establish facts of a situation. But we also all have seen what's called dvarim cho'arim. Dvarim cho'arim are activities that are not themselves, do not qualify as an adulterous affair, but give every indication that those kinds of things were happening between them. And now she's run away, and we don't know where she is. So Yeshua's Malcho said that it seems clear to him that he can get that the husband can get remarried, can get married to a second wife without a heter merabanim, because if you have somebody who's overt al dat, who violates Jewish practice and custom and conduct, and one of the examples is a woman who is, it gives every indication that she might act promiscuously. So Rashad Garshabikal Khora, you could divorce her against her will. And he's saying, now remember, Rav Yosef Shalom Nachman had this whole discussion that we saw last time about whether the Chayr Ben Gershom, about divorcing her against her will, was more or less stringent than the one about him marrying a second wife, and about whether we might prefer forcing a divorce on her than having her marrying a second wife. So in this situation, that won't be allowed, but Yeshua Smolcho doesn't seem to see that they might be contradictory to each other, because he says wherever you're allowed to divorce her against her will, there is no Chayrim Ben Gershom. So this group of Acharonim who Rav Yosef is collecting have taken a very different approach from Rav Yosef Shaul Lotzon, in the sense that they don't see them as contradictory parts of Chayrim Ben Gershom. It's not that you have to choose between divorcing her against her will and marrying a second wife. It's that whenever one would have been allowed to divorce her against her will, meaning that Chayr Ben Gershom wouldn't apply to the situation because you're allowed to divorce her against her will, it also applies that he wouldn't prohibit marrying a second wife. That's what Rav Malcho had claimed. This is especially true when the husband believes this witness and there's some evidence for it, and that's why he allows it. Now, he does think that you should provide a get in case she decides to come and accept it. And he should also take an oath that if you find the opportunity to give her a better get, then you should. But other than that, you shouldn't be more strict with him than you have to be. A reminder that we want to help this man be able to marry, just like we should want to help women be able to marry as well if they're stuck with a husband who's not willing to give them a divorce. You have the Nazir has a similar situation. In his situation, there were full witnesses that she had committed adultery. And he says, Sheshuv einan nikrit ishto, as the Maharik had said, meaning that if she's had an affair such that he's required to divorce her, then the technicalities of her accepting a get or not don't change the fact that he thinks that Avdin Ezer, she's already really not his wife. She's already really not his wife. He doesn't have to worry about Chayr Ben Gershom. In the Avdin Ezer case, though, there weren't actually full witnesses. There were witnesses al Kiyur, right? So Kiyur is things like, we see them, you know, rushing, we knock on a door, we see them rushing out of a room, trying to put their clothing back on. So we have every assumption about what occurred, but we don't have full halachic evidence. So there, too, the Avdin Ezer says, I think that you can still allow it without a heter merabanim, because the Rambam had said that evidence is enough to let her lose her ketubah. and let her enough that the husband can divorce her without having to pay the usual financial agreement. So the question of ketubah is complicated today, and we don't have to get into this because today financial arrangements between men and women are much different when they get married. But in the time of the Gemara, the worry was that husbands would find it too easy to divorce their wives, and they would just get rid of them for things that went wrong in the marriage that aren't sufficient, aren't important enough that they should be, but they'll just fly off the handle. To make that not happen, Chazal instituted a ketubah, which was supposed to provide the woman some financial security and also be a financial barrier to the husband just casually deciding to get rid of her. In a case where she's done kior, where she's had these kinds of physical interactions with a man that give us reason to suspect she's had an affair, but not proof of it, the Rambam held that was enough to lose her ketubah, because the Rambam held that when it comes to monetary matters, the standard of proof, the burden of proof, the true American law as well, the burden of proof is lower, so that the evidence of this kior activity, that as in and its relationship to the possibility that she had an affair, was sufficient for her to lose her money. To lose the money that's coming to her, and also her mizunot, vivda mizunotea, the Avin Ezer says, that the husband no longer has the requirement to support her, right? Because the requirement to support her can also be a financial burden on the husband, and he's not required to do that. This, by the way, just as a side digression, and I apologize for so many, I just don't want to leave these issues not considered in their contemporary applications. This is one of the main ways that Rabbanim today try to make sure that women don't get stranded, by requiring the husband to continue supporting her as long as the two are married. And if, as long as that support happens in certain ways, then husbands, in fact, very often end up giving the get, which is a good outcome. And back in the Avin Ezer's case, so since this husband is not required to support her, not required to give her a ketubah, then it would be like, he says, what Maharam Padua said. Maharam Padua, who lived in Italy in, I think, the 1400s, had said about a different situation. Let's suppose a man and woman had erusin. So erusin is the ring ceremony. So in our times, the ring ceremony is directly linked to the full marriage, but in earlier times, it wasn't true. You could have the ring ceremony and then wait a while to put together the wedding. So after the ring ceremony, there is no obligation on the husband to support the wife yet, because they're not fully married yet. So in that situation, Maharam Padua had said, let's say you get to some situation where she doesn't want to accept a get, but he doesn't want to marry her. However it happens, they're not going to get married, and he wants to marry somebody else, so she's not willing to take a get. Maharam Padua said, V'chayru ben Gershom didn't apply there. Or let's say she, sadly, better example, she sadly goes insane, can't accept a get, can't get married, right? And this poor man wants to get married, and she's not getting cured anytime soon, right? So there, the Maharam Padua had said, since he's not obligated to support her, since there's no financial connection, Rabbi Gershom never meant to prohibit that, the Maharam Padua had said, because, and the Avin Ezer is agreeing, because the whole point of the gzeira of Rabbi Gershom's not letting a man marry two women was because out of a worry. So this is not what we think today. It was out of a worry that maybe he wouldn't have the money to support both of them. So since that's the worry, with an arusa, with a woman to whom he's only betrothed, he only has erusin, not betrothed isn't the right word, but he's only had erusin, so there, since there's no obligation of support, then Maharam Padua claimed Karen Ben Gershom wouldn't apply. The Avin Ezer says, so if that's true about an arusa, about a woman who's only gone as far as erusin, then about this woman who's lost her right to support by virtue of her inappropriate promiscuous activity that leads us strongly to believe that she's probably had an affair, maybe, and he says, there's also not a cherem ben gershom. The cherem doesn't apply, and therefore he thinks that since we have a problem here, that there's no way we're going to get her a get, and it's going to be very difficult that to find a, no, it's not just difficult, and we can't rely on the fact. We don't think this man is willing to wait until we find 100 rabbanim to sign off on his right to marry another woman. So it's better leave a get for the woman in case she wants it for her, or he says in the same way, he says it's good gumber to her. You should, as we saw last time, there are situations where she is, you know, if she's run away and she's not concerned with observance anymore, then it's better for her that we arrange a get for her in absentia and appoint a shaliach for her, because then, at least then, if she has relations with other men, it won't be committing an adulterous affair. So that's what he says you should do, and it's especially true because this man, had not yet fulfilled the obligation of having children, and that's what you should do. So that's the Avin Ezer. Another support for our idea that in a situation where the woman isn't present, isn't willing to accept the get, and is having affairs, and it is therefore either prohibited to the husband, or certainly not having any financial rights on the husband, that in all those situations that there's room to say Rabbeinu Gershom never included that in the prohibition, in his prohibition, in his ban of marrying two women at the same time. Another example is Shut Priya Sadeh said about a woman who left her husband and now she's living with a non-Jew and she doesn't want to accept a get unless he gives her lots and lots of money. Shut Priya Sadeh said, since we know that she left the Jewish people, she's no longer observing Jewish practice, then he can marry another woman. Doesn't even marry about it. That's all the more so in this case, Avad Yosef now says, because we don't even know if she converted properly. Because it was a Beit Din Hidyotot, it was a Beit Din that's not well versed in how to convert people. So we don't know that they did it the right way. We don't know that they understood what they were supposed to be doing. And we don't know if she really accepted mitzvos and other halachos that apply to converts, especially since she's now left the religion. And the Rav Yosef says, V'hare sofa hochiach al techilata. The end of what happened, her leaving the marriage and then completely leaving observance, gives evidence that she never intended it sincerely, that all of her conversion was just for the sake of her husband, that, you know, he wanted to be banging a Jewish wife. So she said, yeah. She said, whatever. Whatever you want. Yeah. So that doesn't count as Kabbalah Olam Mitzvot, and that's a big issue in conversions today as well. And therefore, he says there's even more room here today, here, to say that he can get married without needing a heter mirah, because maybe he was married to a non-Jew the whole time, in which case it wasn't a marriage, in which case he doesn't have a worry. And then Shut Oneg Yom Tov, Rav Yosef points out, said something similar even about a fully Jewish woman. If you have a fully Jewish woman who leaves her husband and then hired her into a non-Jewish household, and now she acts as a non-Jew, and she says she's not Jewish, she declares, you know, she has sadly, in Chas V'Shalom, attached herself to this other religion. The Shut Oneg Yom Tov said he thinks that this husband can get married, in this case, clearly a second wife, and doesn't have to bear up on him, because Rabbeinu Gershom certainly didn't mean to include that when a woman leaves the religion like this, that the husband should be stranded, right? Stranding Jews is nothing that we can imagine that somebody would create, that Rabbeinu Gershom would mean to create a situation of stranding. So that would be all the more so, as he says, in our situation, we don't even know if this first wife was Jewish at all, because we have doubts about her conversion. And then he notes that he has previously mentioned Rabbi Kiva Eger had paskined based on the Maharash Dam, and the Rav Yaakov Melissa, who was a friend of his, the Chavas Das, who was also an important Rav, that agreed that any woman who is Agenet et Baala, who is just causing her husband not to be able to get remarried, it's been more than a year that she hasn't been willing to accept to get, there's no doubt, doesn't need to have to marry about it. So that's a radical psak, because it means that just once a year goes by and she refuses to accept to get, this man can get married to a second wife and not worry about the woman, although he could deposit a get for her. So, and that would be the solution to that situation for that man. The last issue that Rabbi Yosef takes up is that generally in halacha, we require hearing edut, hearing testimony in front of the person being accused, in front of the litigant. So this testimony about her, that she's married a non-Jew, that she might be pregnant by the non-Jew, she wasn't there for it. And there are situations where we say that the testimony cannot be considered valid if it was delivered not in front of the Baal Din. And that if you accept testimony not in front of the Baal Din, that you have to ignore that testimony. You can't do it until she has a chance to be there and to either protest, or to say what she wants to say, or whatever it is. So maybe that's a problem in our situation as well, that we can't act on this testimony yet. For example, the Ramban at Tshuva had quoted a Tshuva of the Rush that said that if people come to give testimony about a woman that she had an affair, and the point would be that he can't stay married to her, he has to get divorced from her, but she wasn't there for it, so the Ramban Paskin, that doesn't count as Eidus at all, he doesn't have to worry about it yet, because until she's there to respond or to be present for the testimony, it doesn't count as testimony. There was a who disagreed, who thought that if the testimony was brought, you can accept it to some extent, that maybe that he can't stay married to her yet, but not enough that you can force her to get divorced from her and you can cause her financial penalties. And that would be, the whole thing would be a big question. The question of whether we can accept testimony or not, Rav Yosef goes back and forth, he has sources on each side. But, and the question also becomes whether monetary cases are different than capital cases. In capital cases, it's very clear. And the question would be, if we're going to accuse her of infidelity, and that's going to lead to her to have financial penalties and to being divorced from her husband or being forced to be divorced from her husband, does that count as monetary law, as civil law, right? Or is it a capital case? So there's also ideas either way that we don't need to get into. They go both ways on that issue, and that could be a complicated question. And Vasily doesn't quite come down on either side of that. He leans more towards saying this is a monetary case, and therefore there's more room to say that you can accept it, the testimony, even when she's not there. But what really clinches the issue for him is that she's refused to come. And then when she's refused to come, so there we're allowed to, and there he quotes Beis Shmuel, that even in a capital case, in terms of the, that even if we call it a capital case because of the ksuba and because of the money and because of what they're saying about her, and they've sent her to come to court a few times, she refuses to come, so then you're allowed to accept the testimony because it's a milta derabbanan. It's a rabbinic issue about chayim ben gershom, right? The question isn't, we're not going to kill her today. We're not going to act on this to say, oh, she's had an affair, she, you know, committed a capital crime. It's that we're wondering whether or not we're going to allow the husband to have a second marriage. That's a rabbinic issue. So if on a rabbinic issue they warned her and she chose not to come, so then we can accept the testimony without her being there. So Safakol, Rabbi Yosef thinks this man can get remarried for all these sets of reasons. Chayim ben gershom probably doesn't apply for several different versions of reasons, and the facts that went into telling us chayim ben gershom doesn't apply can be established by witnesses, even not in the presence of the wife, because she's refused to attend. So that this woman who may be converted and then left and refuses to help us out with letting the husband get remarried by divorcing him in a Beit Din, we don't have to pay attention to her, and we can just allow this man to get remarried and hopefully to have a long and happy marriage with the second wife. And that is a response of the day for the 14th of Tishrei, which clearly has nothing to do with Sukkot, but it's what I found for the Tishrei. But I do wish all of you a Chag Kasher Sameach and a very happy Sukkot. Take care. Have a good day. Responsible day, 14th of Tishrei. Bye.